This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Équipe des Baggies pour tenter sa chance face à Stier. Et Stier intervient face à Hourihane maintenant. Hourihane, c'est dedans. Vas-y. Et encore une fois, Stier qui détourne. Jedinak face à Johnston. Contre-pied, nickel. Stier dans une forme étincelante dans cette séance de tir au but. Cette fois, il n'y peut rien. Jack Grealish, Sam Johnston, qui va gagner le duel entre les deux. C'est Grealish avec le pied gauche. En force peut-être. Non, il l'a placé. Il a marqué un pénalty et qu'il a manqué cette saison. Adoma, au-dessus! Au-dessus pour Albert Adoma! James Morrison ne peut pas rater! Et il ne rate pas! Trois partout! Le tir au but, c'en est fini de la saison de West Brom. Et ça continue pour Aston Villa. Abraham! Et le but! Le tir au but transformé par l'attaquant d'Aston Villa! Villa qui se donne le droit d'aller à Wembley!
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Destiny at Tammy Abraham's feet.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com. And joining me to celebrate the winning of the Battle of the Bastards, I mean the Baggies, Dan Rogers from thevillaunderground.com and Mr. Christopher Burt.
Hello.
Welcome,
hello.
Gentlemen.
Hello, fine people.
Victory is ours.
It was never in doubt.
It wasn't. I mean, did anyone else? We were completely calm for those 120 minutes. I don't know about you.
Penalties were a walk in the park. I was on, you know, I was just deciding which hotel I was going to frequent this time. I told you, this was the test of the playoffs. Baggies over two legs, I thought, was the hardest test that we would be faced with. I'm not saying that we'll win the final by any means, but this was a real test of character, more so than football, because we didn't actually play much football.
It was resolve, wasn't it?
It was, exactly, yeah. Last man standing, and I think I mentioned it in an earlier podcast. You can go in saying, oh, we've just won 10 games and, you know, we have the momentum, but anything can happen in these games, and it's all, the first step is don't get anybody sent off, and we were the only team in the playoffs that didn't lose players.
Chris Frump was desperate to be sent off that game.
And he got his wish, and that was the turning point. Which we will discuss in full in the show coming up. It's a regular show, so we'll kick off with the 3 points. We will go into a variation of the Scott Hogan touch count meter because he is obviously on a beach right now, celebrating potentially a double promotion. And then we'll discuss the Baggies and it was an unlikely prospect, our opponent at Wembley. Derby County, or as they are now known since the last year or so, Frank Lampard's Derby County. Right, let's begin with the 3 points. Point number one, something that cropped up and pretty much headlined a five-hour meeting I had for the Football Supporters Association, as it's going to be called. It's currently, basically, it's the joining up of the Football Supporters Federation and the Supporters Direct. I'm on the National Council, so I get to go to these meetings, I think it's 4 or 5 times a year, to discuss policy and form policy from a supporter's point of view. And one thing that headlined it was this threat of an expansion of the Champions League, or to call it under its other guise, a European league. There's been a company set up which is 50% owned by UEFA, 50% owned by the ECA, which in a nutshell is like the major clubs, you know, Manchester United, Liverpool, your Chelsea's, and then Ajax, Real Madrid, Barcelona, who are all trying to leverage a setup where they will get a bigger chunk of the pie. And there's been ongoing meetings over the next, I think the mid part of May. Recently, there's been a meeting where the French League and the German League have actually resisted calls and voted against it. So that was a good first move. The Premier League will be looking at it soon. I mean, I'm not going to bore you. We'll probably talk about it in a future podcast, but it's basically setting up these leagues where there'll be 4 to 5 teams from per country going into it. This is going to be starting in 2024. The upshot is the Premier League deal will probably lose half of its value in TV rights. There'll be no more parachute payments to championship teams. There'll be less of a trickle down. The Premier League at the moment trickles money down into all the divisions to make up for their shortfall. They'll be ceasing to do that. The Premier League will be reduced to probably 18, 16 teams. You'll probably see the scrapping of the League Cup, and you'll get to a situation where these European games will be on weekends as well. And no doubt the bigger teams will start resting players, you know, when they've got to play Burnley away or something in the domestic league, because their focus will be on this European league. So this is going to be a real... The press haven't really covered it, but it's just one of those things like the 39th game where a league plays one game in Asia or America that people just assume won't happen. But this is apparently a real threat because it's got the big boys behind it. And just to sum up the attitude, I think it's spearheaded by Juventus's owner, and he's essentially of the belief that teams like Juventus, Madrid, Manchester United, Barcelona have built the legacy of Europe, so they should be dining on the table all the time. And it'd basically be impossible for them to get relegated out of it. And when the kind of glory of what happened with Leicester was mentioned, he said, fuck Leicester. You know, they're the ones that have built it, so they should stay there. But anyway, it's something to keep your eyes open for, and hopefully it will be resisted, because it will change football as we know it. Point number two, Chris Budd.
Well, while Villa were travelling the mere 3-4 miles to the Hawthorns, we found out this week that Chelsea and Arsenal will now be off to Baku, Azerbaijan, some 2,468 miles away on the edge of Europe, nearer towards Asia, for their Europa League final. So yeah, so there's no scheduled flights. The only way you can fly direct to Baku for the game would be to leave London the Saturday before and return a week later. Yeah.
If you're listening to me now.
It's an essentially that's an 8-day trip for 90 minutes of football. The train would take more than 4 days, and you could drive, but it'd take you about 58 hours. So take your pick.
What would you do if Villa got into a European game? Well, let's say a Europa League final in Baku. Would you bother?
Just to say I'd been there, I'd go for it. I wouldn't have a reason to go there otherwise.
Ryanair flight in the world, wouldn't you? Chained to your seat.
Even if there was a good chance you'd never come back. Considering it's going to take 58 hours, a good chance you might get lost along the way there.
Actually, I'm not a letter.
You might get there quicker if you were posted.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I'll just cover myself in stamps and hope for the best.
Yeah, that could be the way forward. It reminds me of the...
The Buenos Aires derby, wasn't it? Was it the Copa Libertadores against... It was Boca against River that got moved to Madrid for safety concerns.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Legitimately.
Just a mere 6,000 miles away.
Yeah, I suppose they were legitimate concerns, but a bit of an overkill to actually change continent.
Surprise.
Right, point number three.
Now, this point, I love things like where people get spotted on TV in places where they shouldn't be. And this relates...
What, when you're skiving off work?
Yeah, particularly people who, you know, are skiving off work. I think there's that great video of that guy who was spotted, I think, in a TV interview at the races once with his mistress, and he's trying to edge out of camera. That type of thing. This is the story of a footballer, Jordi van der Laan, who is was a footballer with second tier Dutch side Telstar. Only he called in sick because he just had to get to the semi-final, Ajax's semi-final against Spurs last week. He was caught short having made the trip overseas to Spurs' brand new stadium and was spotted on TV. Oops.
Several times, I think. You think when you escape the country, you're in the clear, but obviously not.
You would think so. I think it's funny because in the BBC report that picks it up, he says his team's group chat exploded and basically it led to him being released by Telstar. And he put out a cheeky tweet the week after for the reverse game, saying that he was actually free this time to go to the to the Amsterdam leg of the tie.
It reminds me of Darren Bent when he was caught shopping on a match day. I think it was under McLeish.
Yeah, we were at home as well.
Yeah, that kind of blew up.
I saw Jonathan Codger shopping as well in Birmingham Airport, but he was only dropping his wife off, apparently.
He was after the hairdressers.
In Lyon.
Speaking of Dutch footballers, former Villa nemesis Rafael van der Vaart has decided to switch careers after retiring from football and has now taken up darts. He won his first competitive match 4-2 over local player Thomas Anderson on Saturday.
I can't wait till he turns up in Wolverhampton on the tour. That'll be a real highlight for him.
It's an interesting one. How you go from football with, you know, all its cash and its glory.
Glamour.
To
let's be honest, glamour.
Yeah.
This is not glamour.
Apparently his brother plays professionally, so I wonder if it's just an excuse to hang out with his brother and have a bit of a laugh. Probably get very smashed in the process.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Do they still drink and dart?
Nah, they're probably on green smoothies these days, aren't they? They're all in peak physical condition, aren't they?
I've tuned into the darts. I'm not sure. They're all... If they were to all strip off their tops, they don't all look like Tyrone Mings underneath.
Who does?
Right, let's get into the purpose, why we are here. First of all, though, just a quick massive thanks and shout out to the new My Old Man Said patrons who have signed up over the last couple of weeks. Rob McClory, Joe Meehan, Pete Brooks, Pat Buckley, Sean Mahone, Stuart Luscott-Evans.
Good name, sir.
Liz Morgan, Jack Davis, Philip Travers, Neil Boucher.
Boucher.
And Alan Jones. Thank you very much.
Stuart, you have a name like a footballer.
An under-23s Aston Villa player, he sounds like. Most of them are double barrels.
It's Joe Meehan. Meehan down the left. It's Pete Brooks. Buckley through to Mahan. Let's get it. It's a goal! So it goes.
What? Oh, my God. This podcast finally coming alive.
Calm down, Jack Woodward.
Thank you very much for supporting independent Villa content, whether I hate that word content, website and podcast that stays away from the horrid cesspit of clickbait. Please do support us and support the show by becoming a My Old Man Said patron. Go to myoldmansaid.com and click on the patron option for more details. Right, quickly, before we get into Villa and Baggies, although this is technically about the Villa and Baggies, Scott Hogan, as we said at the top of the show, is on a beach somewhere counting his muller while contemplating the possibility of a double promotion. So we can't count his touches. So we're going to have a face-off, and I'm going to ask you who had the most touches between two players in the midfield, the fullbacks, and the centre-backs of Aston Villa against the Baggies over...
I already feel like I'm going to lose this game. Let's go. Carry on. Let's go with it.
Over the time of the game, which I think most of these players played the whole match, to be honest.
Okay.
Well, we'll start. First of all, Conor Hourihan versus Jack Grealish. Who had the most touches?
Grealish.
You're allowed to go for the same one, but if it's a tie break, then you have to say how many touches.
I'm going to say Hourihan then.
1-0 to the Rodgers.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, you're cocky.
Hourihan had 100.
Blood is falling apart again.
146 touches from Conor Hourihan. Normally a player in 90 minutes, Grealish, he's got over 100 once or twice over the last season. Normally he's around anywhere between 80 and 90. So Horahan's 146 is pretty exceptional. Jack came in at 126. Right, next one. Fullbacks normally have a lot of touches compared to the rest of the team because it's normally the keeper rolls it out to them. So with that in mind, Elmo versus Neil Taylor. Chris Budd, you go first this time. To stay in the tie.
Taylor.
Dan Rogers.
Elmo.
2-0.
Oh, my
wow.
God.
Pierce.
Oh, my God. Fuck the Chris Budd. Oh. Fuck the Chris Budd. Fuck the Chris Budd. Fuck the Chris Budd.
If anybody follows touches and that kind of stuff, Elmo, there's a good bet Elmo is number one. It's either him or Grealish normally. So 2-0. Just for the sake of it, Mings versus Tuenzebi. Dan Rogers, you go first.
Mings.
It was Mings. We don't need to go into a tiebreaker because the game is already won.
Does this mean I get to throw a wobbly like Patrick Bamford?
We'd have to pick you up off the floor, so, and we haven't got time to do that. Right, going into the game, West Brom Villa. I mean, going into this, I thought the hard part was done because, as we discussed, Dwight Gayle, they're potentially their most potent player in terms of if they were going to beat us at the Hawthorns was gone. But at the same time, because Villa didn't get that third goal to give them a two-goal advantage, West Brom didn't really have to go gung-ho. They could keep their plan, their discipline, how they'd been playing, and just aim to nick a goal. And I think that goal came a bit early for our liking, because that set the game up a bit more as a replica of what happened at Villa Park, didn't it? That was the tone for the rest of the game. And to the credit, Baggies defended very well throughout the whole two legs.
I actually think we started quite well. It was a really good sort of first 20 minutes. We were popping the ball around quite well. And I think the Albion didn't appear to have much to offer at that point. You thought it was always going to be, you know, very back to front, and Mings and Tuenzebi were going to be, you know, bombarded with under the high ball. But Albion's goal just sort of came from nowhere, really. And it was just a dreadful sort of Sunday league, typically Villa-esque goal to concede. It was dreadful from start to finish.
Wasn't it, the goal?
I mean, there was the foul in the lead up to it. But to be honest, the way Villa defended it, they didn't deserve to get the break of the ball there at all.
Yeah, I thought Mings is meant to be there to not for us to get out-muscled in situations like that.
He's certainly been wobbly, hasn't he, over both games, I think?
Yeah, we're not as robust as I kind of was thinking that we were. I mean, when we played Leeds recently, we did kind of go toe-to-toe, so I thought, come the final, if Leeds got there, that we would be able to match them if it turned into a physical game. But the Baggies, at times, seemed like they were like grown-up men, and we were a bit lightweight at times in terms of the physical battle. I mean, McGinn wasn't getting much purchase. Grealish was struggling to, you know, make a real impact because sometimes they were just getting shrugged off.
I think because the Albion played their press, you know, they sat back to the halfway line. They were just letting us have the ball. And then all of a sudden, they sort of just converged around the ball as soon as we crossed the halfway line. So I think similarly to the game at Villa Park, they just set themselves up to play in a certain way. And it was just two completely contrasting styles that kind of didn't, you know, obviously didn't complement each other for a good, entertaining game of football, but it was a very hard watch at times.
Yeah, it was a hard watch at times. I think what we saw was that when you have Hourihan in the side, that the midfield always looks a bit lighter, I think, for not having someone like Whelan in there and mopping up.
I was going to say, before the semi-final kicked off, the consensus on this show, well, certainly from myself, was in terms of that Conor Hourihan, Glenn Whelan toss-up, I would be playing Conor Hourihan, starting him in the home leg and then Whelan in the second leg.
Yeah.
And Smith went the opposite way. And I don't know if Smith was reacting because Conor Hourihan obviously scored and made an impact. And that's why he started.
I think it was a bit of making a statement, wasn't it? The fact that they'd finished so well in the first leg that he said, you know what, we're going to get on the front foot here, which they tried to do.
Do you think it came undone a little bit with they got that early-ish goal, and we weren't playing badly, I don't think, in the first, as you say, first 20 minutes. We rocked a little bit after that. I think we were faced with the prospect of, not that it wasn't a chance of that happening in game and the Albion would score, but I think that we'd come with such confidence that I think we thought we would maybe get that goal ourselves first. And it took us till half time to regroup, actually.
Yeah.
You do wonder what else comes into it around, you know, is there a little bit of fatigue there?
Certainly mentally.
You know, is he carrying a little bit of an injury suggestion of a knock, Mings?
Yeah, Mings had a tight hamstring, hadn't he? And he was cramping up towards the end of the game.
You could see it.
But he was shaky in the first leg as well.
Yeah. The frustrating thing was, I suppose, that considering how much of the ball we had, we still managed to play ourselves into trouble because the Albion offered so little at times and showed no real interest pushing on until we gave the ball away. We just were the architects of our own downfall at times.
Yeah, I was going to say we were our worst enemies at times. I mean, Steer's distribution as well was a bit questionable at times.
Which is scary in-game, actually.
It's something we've been saying all season, isn't it, at times, that if Villa are on their A game, they're going to be a match for anyone in the division. But our own worst, our biggest sort of rival is ourself. And it's been the case with Villa for a number of years.
You think, we're sort of thinking of the game more broadly, that though we lost our way a little bit in the early part of the first half, were we guilty of trying to overplay the ball into our opponent's net thereafter?
I think it was...
Well, a few people have said to me we looked nervous in the final third. And I kind of agree. It didn't look like we were playing on instinct. It was kind of overthought. And I think partly that was obviously because the Baggies had frustrated us. But they were playing very well and we didn't seem to have... It reminded me of Villa back in the days of Martin O'Neill trying to break teams down at Villa Park when our away form was okay because teams would open up on their patch. But at Villa Park, they would come to defend, do pretty much what the Baggies did. And we didn't really have the guile or the conviction to break them down.
And did you think that in amongst that there was some... I just kept finding myself thinking the same thing over and over again, be it with the some of the defensive mistakes that put us in danger or some of the opportunities that went by. They seem like very individual errors, often impulsive, you know, especially in front of goal. We seem to get into really dangerous positions time and time again. And then there'd be a scuff shot or an impulsive attempt at goal that you just thought, just with a bit of composure.
Give us some examples.
Oh, for instance, I think McGinn scuffed one wide, Adoma, after he'd come on, lumps one into the stand behind the goal. There was a great ball across in either half, I think one in the first half, across the face of goal from Taylor to Abraham, where if he'd have just gambled. And in the second half, I think Almo put one in between the keeper and the six.
Yeah, it was a cracking ball, the one in the second
fantastic ball that you think, why haven't we read that,
Also, I think, why weren't we doing more of that, when we clearly weren't going to be able to play through the middle against, a five-man back four and a midfield four. Why didn't we try and get around the side? We just almost like we didn't have the belief, be it Green or Algarzi or Adoma, we don't actually have the belief that we could get to the byline and deliver.
And I think at times we suffered. I mean, considering how West Brom were playing and also the fact for both games that there were patches where they were playing with 10 men, I thought we were lacking that extra midfielder in the box making a run in. You talked about because some of the balls that went in were good, but there was just nobody there. And you just thought, if we want to win this game, and okay, you're going to side on caution a little bit because you don't want to give a goal away, but this was a West Brom team that wasn't really offering that much. And at times you just thought, if you just had another runner coming in, if they just, I don't want to say gamble, but conviction.
It was the same with the set players as well. I know that the Baggies have a strong back three and they're all tall guys, but we're still the team in the league who's scored the most from set plays. And the amount of times we were going for short corners, and every time we had the ball in wide areas, we'd roll it back, we'd overplay. There's so many occasions where you just thought, just put it in the box and compete. Give yourself a chance.
Especially with the height that we have in set plays as well. I mean, time and time
again. And the delivery that we have as well. The quality of the players who can put a ball on a sixpence in Grealish, McGinn and Hourihane, especially recently.
Algarzi too. And that was the disappointing thing. There any number of times that, though I do think Algarzi can struggle for a decision, especially when he's running with the ball. His end product is fantastic. He's very accurate.
Yeah.
But it was contrasted on the other side by, I thought Green had didn't really impact upon the game at all.
He doesn't, does he, when he starts games? I don't think. He's a great really impact sub, but I just, whenever we've seen him, even against quite average sides, he just doesn't seem to start the game.
No.
When Brunt went off, I thought Villa was safe from that point, obviously going down to 10 men.
Well, the Albion were never going to show any more than they already had. It was just literally, let's just put all our men on the 18-yard line and hope for the best.
I mean, that left us with 40 minutes, included extra time to seal the deal. And obviously, we didn't take advantage of them going down to 10 men at Villa Park. So I was a little bit disappointed we didn't finish the game off there and then. But also, I kind of expected we wouldn't because West Brom were just doing what they were doing, essentially. It didn't really alter their defensive makeup. And obviously, Rodriguez went off eventually as well. But Brunt sending off, while we're on the subject of it. I mean, initially he stood on McGinn's arm. I think that was potentially accidental.
It was just the dwelling on that when he planted his foot. And I'm not in the just last week that we had opposition fans the Albion fans rewinding Grealish's, the Gibbs foul on Grealish for the penalty in ultra slow motion and all that.
Yeah.
You know, live it looked like a stamp. The replay in real-time speed to me, it just looks like he plants his foot. You know, a few minutes later he cleans him out again, and then in the second half he hacks him down.
Yeah.
For me, he was just asking. It was very not dissimilar to Dwight Gale. You just think, how many times is this player going to commit a yellow card offence?
The funny thing about Grealish, I mean, that's why we wanted to play Leeds in the final, because as well as, you know, them being the two biggest clubs in the league and you know, the tradition as well, the recent kind of social media fire that started, it's a bit of a Newcastle vibe, but also because we played them recently and what happened in that game, I really wanted to play Leeds in that final, but you know, they fell apart once again. I think it's the fifth time they failed in the playoffs. But all the grief they're giving on Grealish, an interesting stat that popped up: Grealish has not been booked for simulation or retrospectively banned for it in three seasons of Championship football. And during that time, he's been fouled 336 times. So he's either very good at getting away with it, or he's kind of playing within the rules of the game. And, you know, the penalty, going back to the Villa Park leg, that was just the classic drag your back leg. When the player dives in, once he's down, you know you've got him, because you just drag your back leg. It makes contact. And it's just, it's a bit of a, what do you call it, a loophole, because by law, the contact's there, even though you're pretty much playing for it. But there's nothing you can do. Well, VAR, whatever, is not going to change the opinion.
Gibbs knew exactly what he'd done, didn't he, straight away? There was no complaints from him. Hey.
Exactly. No protest on the field. And I was surprised that it was, I think the Baggies pushed it before the FA board, didn't they? And they looked at it with an independent panel.
I mean, ultimately, while there's not, you know, it's not like a strong, meaty tackle that goes through him, he's nowhere near the ball and he's dived in the box. It's like there is no one in football who would say, oh, that's borderline.
I was sat right behind that. For me, it was
a stupid decision.
It was a foul as well. You know?
It was rash, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because going back about five seasons, I think it was at Anfield when Villa were making a good fist of playing against Liverpool, and then I think Liverpool equalised with a penalty when Suarez broke through. Guzan came flying out, but he didn't touch him. Didn't touch him at all. Suarez admitted after the game to Guzan, but he didn't touch him. And you look at the, you know, you bit match of the day, the pundits is going, well, you know, he shouldn't be sliding in like that. Well, he didn't touch him. So it's not a penalty. And they went around the panel, they didn't even show you the evidence. They just said, yeah, Guzan's fault, it was a penalty. Actually, they didn't actually show one slow motion replay or anything. They just made their minds up. But I'm sorry, but if you don't touch a guy and he pulled his arms away, it's not a penalty. But in this case, Grealish was touched, even if it's like a limp touch, it's a penalty.
If there's no contact, that's called simulation, isn't it, Patrick Bamford?
Yeah.
And bringing it back to Brunt, I think it was targeted stuff at one of our best players. You know, I don't think it's any surprise that McGinn was being kicked all over the pitch. The first challenge where he kicks him off his feet particularly was bad.
It was awful.
Yeah, and I think that it's no different to what the Blues were doing. You know, Blues targeted Grealish in both the Derby games within 5 seconds of the kickoff both times. And to be honest, in the game against the Albion, the Scandinavian midfielder tried to dead leg Grealish a couple of times by you know, checking him. You know, it's the dark arts, isn't it?
And the bottom line is their game plan is to stop us rather than you know, concentrating on what they're doing, which shows you there's a lot of respect out for what we, you know, how teams perceive us and what our capabilities are, and that's, you know, shows you why we are was potentially the biggest threat to any team in this playoffs. But I think if we don't get those two sending offs, I struggle to say with any conviction we'd have got through this semi-final, because I don't think we did enough. You know, we kind of relied on the Baggies to self-destruct in some respect.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And we only got through, really, because of modern football. It was modern football and Sky that wanted the playoffs. If there was no playoffs, we'd have been fifth and people would have been laughing at us. And I remember at the time, you know, there was, as there is to any change, there was resistance going, well, that's not very fair. If a team that can finish fifth all of a sudden can qualify, you know, over a team that's finished third.
Wow.
There was a lot of resistance to that at the time. So we've benefited from that. And then we've also benefited from the away goals rule being scrapped, because we'd have been out if it was still in play.
But it's not, so it doesn't matter.
So the dark arts of modern football have got us through this tie.
No, grit and determination, perseverance.
And do you know what? And keeping our heads. Albion have had three players sent off in three games, and all of them have been completely avoidable.
True.
In three games?
Yeah. And Robson Kanu got sent off stupidly on the final
day
of the season.
Before. Right, gotcha, yeah.
You know,
it
Robson
has cost them.
Got sent off.
It has cost them.
And Gale.
You know.
And you're not talking about like squad players. These are three big, big players for the Albion.
Do you know where that really hurt them? It really hurt them when penalties came up, because they they were really scrabbling around for the Isaiah Osbournes of the world, weren't they, for penalty kick takers?
Well, their mascot was almost had a shoe in to take the. I think if it went to a sixth penalty, sudden death, it was the mascot who was going to be trundling up.
Is that the bird or the fridge?
The bird, I think this time.
Lucky bird.
But before that, we skipped over one point. The probably the best chance of the game was Adomar's
chance
that forced a very good save from Johnson. That was the time where you knew it was going to penalties, I think.
Mm-hmm. It was that moment where I just thought, do you know what, maybe this just isn't our day.
No, I felt confident as soon as the Brunt went off, because penalties, you could see Smith started to make substitutes for penalties.
Yeah,
and they worked.
And we had our full selection of takers. I mean, to the extent that even Codger couldn't get on the top five list.
That's true.
No.
But unfortunately, the Baggies, I mean, Rodriguez was out, Dwight Gale was gone, Brunt's one of their better takers. They were their main three players.
Robson Kanu would have probably taken one.
Robson Kanu, exactly.
If Gareth Barry had been fit, he'd have normally buried penalties.
So I was more than confident in penalties. And, you know, Jedinak came on. I mean, we should have done a touch count on Jedinak.
One.
Exactly, and that was in the net, so...
Unvilla thing to do. The fact that, you know, that's the kind of thing that other teams do, and you think, wow, I wish we could bring on some
guy.
Wish
we could bring on an Australian with a great beard.
Bring on the destroyer of worlds.
Well, I mean, that's what I meant. Confident when he was one of the penalty takers, I thought fantastic, because this is a guy that took penalties for fun in the last World Cup and scored, and he's got nerves of steel. He didn't give a shit.
I mean, straight away, as with a lot of stuff with them, as with so much with Smith, straight away it just said, oh, well, there's clearly a plan here.
Yeah.
That he knows what he's doing straight away.
Yeah. As he said in his post-match, they'd been working on penalties since the day that they'd qualified for the playoffs.
Since the Millwall game. So they've had probably 2 or 3 weeks of penalty prep.
Yeah.
I think Steer said he's faced well over 100. Or so penalties.
In some respects, a lot of that research into West Brom penalty takers would have gone out the window because half of them weren't obviously on the pitch.
Self-imposed bans. How will your blood pressure be when we go to penalties at Wembley?
Well, that's another story. I mean, to be honest, I was reasonably cool in this one. Just from who we had to take, they say penalties are a lottery, but they're not really when you've got the first five players are actually recognised penalty takers against four or five players that I mean, the young kid that went up to take the first one. And this is something that's interesting because we're not this soft touch anymore. Steer was just staring him out.
Well, he walked. Did you see that? He followed him from the halfway line, didn't he?
Yeah, and just kept looking at him.
It was very uncomfortable, actually, on second viewing.
The best bit is, like, you see, he's looking at him. And then the West Brom player clocks him looking at him and he's like, yeah. And then Steer looks away. And then he immediately looks at him again just to give him the double freak out. And that obviously worked a treat. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, yeah, we're playing the dark arts here. This is what I want to see. This is getting good practice in for Leeds. And obviously we're not playing Leeds now, which is a shame because we've obviously got some tricks up our sleeves for them.
I mean, a word of obviously for the Steer, who was, you know, had his amazing moment from where he started the season. You know, the first save, I think if you go the right way, you'd expect him to save that one. He's beaten with the mind games. But the second one from Hegazi is an incredible penalty save because the guy's hit it right in the bottom corner and hit it hard. And it's such a strong hand. It's a brilliant save.
Yeah, because the Baggies penalties, to be fair, were not, you know, they weren't softy ones, were they? No, they were reasonably well struck. There weren't any weak penalties there. Not like Albert at Omar's.
Which was awful. But and to be fair, all the Villa ones were, you know, the ones that went in, clearly, were really well hit. You know, the Grealish ones right in the corner. The Hourihane one to start off with is superb. The Jedinak one's fantastic, as you'd expect. And Abraham sort of, you could see on the replay, did Johnson with the eyes, as they say.
Yeah.
Waited for him to go and rolled it in.
Because Abraham's obviously missed one in recent memory. When they miss their first two, you're thinking, yeah, we're going to Wembley. And then Adomar steps up and then you think, oh, here we go. There's a twist coming here. And you weren't 100% on Abraham. I mean, you probably, let's say you were 70, 80%. 75, 80.
Johnson got a touch to it, didn't he? He got a nick to it. But
it was enough. And actually, we're on a good... Historically, we're on a pretty decent run on penalties. I mean, since the Tranmere Rovers 94 semi-final, which that was one that I talking about going to hell
that
and
one
back.
Went back and forth a couple of times, didn't it?
That was a humdinger when they've, you know, when they had penalties to win the game.
Well, we missed two and they missed three or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's swung a couple of ways. Then since then, we've beaten Inter Milan, Bolton, Sunderland and...
Sorry, we can't go past Inter Milan. We can't go past Inter Milan without mentioning Phil King.
Shout out to Phil King if you're listening.
You beauty.
Great celebration as well.
Yeah,
one of my favourite.
Iconic photograph. That is.
Favourite. And there's just a smile on his face. Mm-hmm.
It was the look of a man who was saying, what am I doing here? Brilliant.
No, he was happy. He's with his little Muller shirt on.
Oh.
One of my favourite penalty wins, which isn't counted, is when we beat Juventus in the Peace Cup. When Buffon was in goal, trying to fend off the likes of Barry Bannon and Mark Albrighton, who hadn't actually been seen around the Villa first team at that stage.
And Alessandro Del Piero probably took one of the worst penalties ever seen on a football field.
But the funniest thing about that penalty is Guzan is getting all hyped up. He's like going, you know, left and right, he's jumping up and down, blah, blah, blah. And then Del Piero does that little dink, but miskicks it. And Guzan's still jumping up and down. And then he's just realised, hang on a minute, this ball's just trickling to me. So Guzan's looking a bit of a fool. And he almost panicked when it just trickled towards him because he was expecting, you know, to do something real drastic. Shock and awe.
Oh, and then underwhelmed.
And then, fuck. Did he just kicked it straight back at him, didn't he? Yeah, fuck you!
Just smashed it back with
insult me.
Absolute disdain, wasn't it?
It was like, how dare you insult me and my fellow Villa men?
Have some professional pride, man.
Yeah. That was a great moment. It's a shame that cup's not really worth anything in the grand scheme of things.
No, it's probably seized by Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs last season.
To Villa fans, to Villa fans of a certain age that bear deep grudges, that was, to me, I celebrated that more than actually when we beat the Baggies earlier in this week. Because I was celebrating revenge for when they knocked us out the European Cup the year after we won it. Yeah. We've never been back since. So I like to take small victories where I can get them.
You've got to take what you can get these days, Dave.
Exactly. I mean, come on. So at the end of the day, it was a war of attrition. Mm. We're in the final. Yes. And as I said before, I thought that would be our toughest test. And I mean... It was.
I mean, while it was a tough test, I think we can all agree that actually over the two legs, Villa still actually did deserve to go through just for the simple fact that you can't play against a team and concede 73% of the ball at home, 69% of the ball away, and actually expect to go through. Like, Albion didn't show any willing to actually go and win the tie. So for that alone, at least Villa tried to have a go.
What did you think of our penalty appeal in the second half for the handball?
I think the ref's placement is behind their player, isn't it? I think if he sees it, he gives it. Because that's one of those penalties you think you've seen that given a lot of times. Mm-hmm. I mean, Al-Ghazi had one, didn't he, in the first half against. I think we probably dodged a bullet there as well, but it is a penalty.
Because the referee's close enough, but one of their players just runs in his eye line just as it happens. Yeah, just wrong place at the wrong time for us anyway, for that Baggies player. But I think you'd have given that.
I did think that live.
And interestingly, after the game, I hadn't even realised until I saw online, it was the first time we'd failed to score since we played the Baggies at home in February.
Wow.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that one of the things we pride ourselves on, and I think you, Chris, mentioned it in the last show, was we pretty much score in every game. Mm. But this is two times now in four games we failed to score against the Albion. And something is interesting. I mean, what do we get marks for in this semi? Do we get it for our football? No. Do we get it for our, I don't know, killer instinct? No. Our ideas? No. But we get it for the grit. We get it for the spirit. Just that resolve, which, if you're going to win things, sometimes you need that to get you over the line. I mean, I'm hoping that the game against Derby in the final isn't a matter of a war of attrition and the last men standing get over the line and get promoted. I'm hoping it's a bit more open and both teams can have a pop at each other.
Unless we forget that the Hourihane goal is probably the standout sort of footballing moment of the whole time. To have, you know, we still did manage to show bits of quality and...
Well, we did try to play football. That was the thing.
That's the thing. I don't think it wasn't necessarily that we played badly and that we were just clueless. I just think we were very frustrated and probably you'd use the word sort of ineffective rather than bad.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like we were, you know, especially in the home leg, I didn't think we played badly. We just weren't, effective going forward. But actually, we never looked in huge amount of trouble. It wasn't like we were spraying the ball around left, right and centre and banging it out for a throw-in every 5 minutes or over-hitting crosses. We were just frustrated for two games. And to be fair, you have to give Albion credit for that. You know, they had their game plan and they executed it perfectly. And you say, fair play to them. But we got the job done that we needed to in the way that we wanted to do it.
To be fair, I mean, if I was feeling a bit fatalistic through the whole tie, the point was probably at Villa Park in the first half, because we looked a bit blunt in terms of what we could, what we were offering to get through there. Very disciplined, very organised.
There was one point in, I think it was like stoppage time in the first half at Villa Park, where we'd been pissing around with the ball in our own half. We'd knocked it out for a needless throw-in, which Gale was winding up a long one, and you could almost sense the anxiety of, we're going to concede a second here, a really stupid second goal. Luckily, we got it out and went on and won it. But we were probably only one mistake away from losing the tie.
From serious trouble,
which was actually very avoidable against a team that was showing so little willing.
Right, anyway, enough of the Baggies game. It's over. It's history. Hopefully, we don't see them again. And you can add the Leeds to that. You can add the Blues to that. And to get to that position where we don't have to mix with the Ravel for at least a season, we've got to beat Derby County first. Shout out to Lampard's men, because they were in this position where they had nothing to lose after losing the first leg 1-0. And, I mean, that was a hell of a open game compared to what we've witnessed over two legs against West Brom. And it just turned into a firefight. And considering the two games between the teams when they've played, that Leeds have bettered them 6-1 over two games, you'd expect Leeds to win that. But Leeds, I mean, literally are falling apart.
Yeah.
At this Football Supporters Association meeting that I mentioned at the top of the show, I was sitting next to a Leeds man, and he said he feared they would go out in the semi-final. He said, you know, we've just completely lost it.
Well, I said a couple of podcasts ago that for me, they looked like a team that had just lost all discipline.
Yeah, they'd run their race.
From top to bottom. I think they were massively rocked by the Spygate thing.
Yeah.
You know, when we played them a couple of weeks ago, even if you take out the bizarre walk-in goal that they allowed us to have, they didn't strike me as a team that looked like it was promotion ready. Another fact I didn't know about them is I think they're the only team from the last 10 seasons or so of the Championship who have been top at Christmas and not gone up.
That's what we said in the last podcast.
Yeah, that frames the collapse for me.
The other stat is Leeds have never, ever beaten the same team four times in a season. You don't normally play your team four times in a season. Oh, so wow. That fact may be a bit dodgy when you look back in Leeds history to see how many times they've played a team four times. But the football gods have a funny way of evening things up. And this is what I'm a bit tentative about, this final against Derby. Is you look at our two former games against them and you're thinking 7-0 over two games, 4-0 at Villa Park, 3-0 at Baseball Ground or Pride Park, whatever it's called. And you're thinking, do the gods of football allow this? Will they allow a clean sweep? I always remember one example when Liverpool hammered Crystal Palace 9-0 in the league and then played them in the FA Cup semi-final and Palace won 4-3.
I remember when Liverpool played us in the FA Cup semi-final, having already beaten us 3-0 at Anfield, 2-0 at Villa Park, and then subsequently dispatched us 3-0 in the FA Cup, didn't they, as well? With Robbie Fowler single-handedly destroyed us in all three games.
That was a semi-final.
Yeah, I suppose you can bring up evidence for both sides of the coin. But I think, just looking at the game quickly, because I'm sure we'll do a show on the game in itself. One thing, as I mentioned... And the last show was how Derby seemed to have toughened up. I mean, after Villa, they were the second informed in terms of the playoff teams left. Well, there's only two now.
They'd only lost one in 12, hadn't they?
Exactly. They'd won six, drawn five, which suggests we consider them a bit lightweight and easy to play against. And, you know, Leeds and Villa fans would have said that before the playoffs. But they seem to have a bit more resolve now because they're not getting beat when they used to get beat.
No.
And they look lively against Leeds. But I mean, to be honest, Derby were not defending well, even at the end when Leeds, they were man down for most part of the closing stages. But, you know, those Derby midfielders weren't getting back. They weren't tracking back quickly. And Leeds had space to do something. But, you know, we know about Leeds in the last few months, their finishing's been atrocious.
It was just two teams that couldn't defend, wasn't it? It was the theme of the whole game.
And we've just been practicing over 210 minutes against, ironically, the weakest defensive team going into the playoffs, but a team that actually defended, like Lions.
They were superb.
Yeah. So we've had great practice in that respect. So I thought both Leeds and Derby were a bit flimsy at the back. So either or, I was kind of quite content. I just would, you obviously get more pleasure beating Leeds after the recent game we've played against them. And it would be a bigger day.
It would have been a rerun of the 96 League Cup final as well. Which...
Yeah.
Yeah, apart from this time, it would have been 4 or 5 nil. You bet your bottom dollar on that, boys. Chris, what's your first thoughts about Frank Lampard's Derby County?
Bring it on. Bring it on.
And the poor man's Jack Grealish, Harry Wilson.
The same applies with Villa going into the final as it did with the semi-final as it's been for the last few months, as it's been a lot of the season, and that is the same thing of, if we turn up and play our game well, we'll be fine. And I stand by that because it's been proven over the throughout the season.
Well, if we turn up, that's the first thing, isn't it?
There seems a real focus and an urgency. And even you could see after the game, with the players being interviewed and Smith, that they are very focused. They knew that they'd enjoy the moment at the Hawthorns, but the job is very much not done. You know, I think both Derby and Villa have Derby have gone a step further than they went last year, but Villa definitely want to go the next step from last year as well, I think.
I think bottom line, Lampard's proven himself already. I think beating Leeds and the whole Spygate, getting revenge for Spygate, et cetera, first season in management, people casting suspicious looks about, playing on his name, that's the only reason he got the job, whatever. I think he's proven himself. And Smith, the only way he proves himself at Villa is to get promoted. I mean, that's the short of it, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. But and he's not going to be in a better position.
I think to have gone on the run they went on, to get in the position they were, to get through against the Baggies in the manner that they did, I think you would be, would it be more disappointing than last year? Because last year we lost to what we knew was a very good Fulham side.
Yeah, and I think Derby fans will be thinking what we were thinking going into that game against Fulham.
Yeah.
We were kind of faking it when we're trying to give it the big one when we were going to play Fulham, because you've got to put on a bit of bravado. Underneath, we thought, well, we're going to have to fucking pull this one out the hat if we're going to win this.
Yeah, I think we knew that Villa, it's that thing, Villa could win it. They're capable, but are they on their day? Yeah. That we would have needed to raise our game, and Fulham would have needed to have an off day. which they didn't.
What's often forgotten about that game is not only did we barely cross the halfway line in the first half and didn't force a corner, but we also played Fulham with, they were down to 10 men for the last 20 minutes. And it was not like the Alamo. It wasn't like a bombardment. I mean, Grealish...
They nearly scored on the break.
Yeah, skipped through once, ran out of space at the end to really have a proper finish. And that was about it. And it was like...
It was limp, wasn't it, the whole thing?
Yeah, it was like slowly getting executed. I mean, the Arsenal game was a brutal execution. This was just like having your toenails pulled out slowly or something. It was... Not the way you want to go. I'd rather have the Arsenal one, because at least you know when you're 3 or 4 nil down, you can fuck off out of there.
Well, we knew, you know, in the Arsenal game, we knew by the time the first goal had arrived, we should have been about 4-0 down already.
I think that we're a long way away from there now. And I have to say, even despite what we've said about Leeds, I am astonished that we'd be playing Derby in the final.
You know, from to be 2-0 up on aggregate, having taken the lead at home, to implode in quite the manner they did.
It's quite
shows a complete lack of game management, doesn't it, really?
And I think we've got to be mindful of that how buoyed Derby will probably be from that victory and from getting into the playoffs and, you know, a similar run to ourselves, a similar confidence to ourselves. I think that what we've got to do is we've got to get back to the really refocusing on what got us on that great run, what sustained it. And it is not a massively different Derby team. Granted, they've improved since we, you know, we battered them. For me, I'm done with the Championship now. I can't walk away from Wembley having lost again.
I'm done with the sort of all the novelties, all the things that we've laughed at. I'm done with the shit referees. I'm done with getting ripped off to go to away games. You know, the time is now.
I'm done with celebrating the opening of the upper tier of the Trinity for games.
Yeah. I'm done with getting turned over at Brentford every year.
We have 90 minutes.
I'm bored of playing the Blues.
Yeah, I am as well.
Yeah.
We have 90 minutes where we can solve all our ills and go back to obscurity in the Premier League. You know, you have some assholes saying, oh, we'll only get relegated, blah, blah, blah. We've actually got a team now with momentum. We're going to need some, let's say, a little bit of magic in the transfer window to, A, secure some of our players that we want to keep. And B, upgrade in certain places, especially like on the flanks, I would say. But with the owners we've got, we have the expectation of what owners have we got? Let's see, you know, for real, what their ambitions are. And to be fair, I mean, Edens has turned the Milwaukee Bucks from zeros to heroes. I mean, they're in the playoffs.
They're
proper
a force,
playoffs.
Aren't they?
And that's been a 5-year turnaround. So.
Well, and a huge transformation in infrastructure as well as, I mean, they've built an unbelievable stadium.
So maybe he's got the Midas touch in that respect. So you've got that. And you've got that prospect if you look at that Premier League, and you know it's not all that. So none of this, I mean, even the best Villa teams like Graham Taylor, when they went up, they took a season to consolidate and fought off relegation.
That's important.
In the last few games. And then the next season, they were battling it out for the title. I mean, obviously the game's a bit different now, but it just, I think you look at what Wolves have done. Villa have still a force in terms of size and name, and the fans will quickly switch back to the mode of knowing who they used to be. And I think we've got a team now, even, you know, at this moment, would be competitive against at least half of the Premier League as it stands. So now is the time. We can't do another season, because another season could potentially, you'll see the weeds appearing at Villa Park, and it could, one more season could easily be 10 seasons and we'd become a Leeds. And imagine that. It's like being in Dante's Inferno, bickering with Leeds fans over social media for another decade.
Groundhog Day.
About absolute
Jesus Christ.
Nonsense.
So the upshot is there is no alternative but to win that game by any means necessary. And I think,
I don't care how we win, I'm
in
happy
recent
to
times
record,
we've managed to get the job done,
and Villa are demonstrating they have that they have that little nastiness, they have that willingness to tussle. And you know, you saw it in what Steer did to their player. Now I want a bit of that, and Villa haven't had that kind of win by any means necessary. We're the ones who fall victim to the cheating players. And you know, I'd rather have people bagging Grealish out and him winning free kicks and getting results than being a victim of it.
It's a case of just get the job done, however you have to do it now, get it done. It doesn't necessarily come about performance-wise now. It becomes purely a one-off results game.
Yeah, I mean, but saying that, in summation, if we play to our best ability and Derby play to the best of their ability, I think we win that game.
Well, we should.
No, I'm telling you, we win it.
They can't
beat us. If we're both playing at the top, we're a better team. But the problem is Villa need to play it there. And, you know, Derby could nullify a threat, show us something we haven't seen before, and shock us.
Is it strange to be going into a Wembley, sort of a showpiece final, for the first time in, I would probably say, since the Bolton semi-final in 2000, as probably the favourites, where we haven't actually been in this position for a long time?
Mm.
You know, Fulham, we weren't the favourites. Obviously, you know, the Arsenal-Liverpool that season, we weren't the favourites then. Man United won, obviously, we weren't the favourites then. Chelsea, when we played Chelsea, we got absolutely battered by them 7-0 earlier in the season. Chelsea, when we lost,
were the favourite against Leeds, and that's about it.
Yeah, and obviously when we played Bolton in the 2000, you know, we were playing against the low division side. But
And that game was a bit like this Baggies game,
horrible,
to be honest.
Wasn't it?
Yeah,
the game at the Hawthorns kind of reminded me of the Middlesbrough games over both legs last year that were just non-events as a footballing spectacle. Whereas, you know, the Leeds game was kind of the absolute opposite.
There's a little bit of two teams being too scared to lose,
which I don't think that mentality suits this Villa team this year.
No.
Last year's team, it kind of played into the, you know, play it safe, you know, grind it out type style. That doesn't work with this team. You become, you know, when you're trying to knock it around and you're cautious, you end up making silly mistakes and you play with a lack of conviction, which you can't play a high tempo passing game if you lack conviction. It just, the whole thing falls apart.
Well, we just can't freeze in the final. That's the main message, and it's death or glory. Before we go, please do subscribe if you listen on Apple Music or Spotify, follow us on there so you are updated instantly, or any other podcast app. Please do become a My Old Man Said patron. Also, if you can, we've got some bonus podcasts lined up. There'll probably be more bonus podcasts than real shows over the summer transfer window, to be honest. So please do sign up there. Or alternately, you can become a Facebook supporter. Just see the Facebook page and you'll see the badge to click on there. Right, we better get down to the yard and start building this Aston Villa canal boat for the long voyage down the canals to Wembley Way.
Well, we better get on the water, hadn't we? It's going to take a long time to get there. So,
Yeah.
You speak for yourselves. I'm going to take the Villa underground.
Well, I've got a speedboat motor that I'm going to put on the end of it. We're just going to carve up those canals.
Going to be a canal boat on steroids.
Exactly. Right. Until the next show. It's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
We're going to Wembley, baby! Let's go!
My old man said...
Vai levar o time para Wembley, para a grande decisão. E pode ser agora. Ele contra o goleiro John Stone. Para quinta e última cobrança, Abraham! Gol!
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.